Good afternoon. I'm Diane Denton in the Office of Public Information. I'd like to welcome you. And we wanted to provide a press briefing this afternoon to provide an opportunity for updates on the Holy Conversations following this morning's witness. Some of the bishops do have some time restrictions due to previous commitments, so we'll have about 30 minutes for our briefing, and including questions today. Joining us today is Reverend Gail Murphy Geis, who is the chairman of the Commission on the General Conference, Bishop Gregory Palmer, who is the president of the Council of Bishops, Reverend Troy Plummer, who is the executive director of the Reconciling Ministries Network, Bishop Sally Dick, and Bishop Scott Jones. We hope that Bishop Machado may be able to join us also during the briefing. I'm going to turn this over to Bishop Palmer at this time, and we'll have comments from persons on the stage, and then we'll take questions from the floor after that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Diane, and welcome to all of you. I want to express my deep sense of gratitude for the magnificent way in which the delegates and observers and otherwise participants to the General Conference carried themselves this day as we received a witness from sisters and brothers in Christ within the United Methodist community whose concerns, understandably so, are around a church that is more fully inclusive of people that now feel excluded. And I thought the witness went on beautifully, and the responses to it in terms of pastoral and leadership roles in the life of the church were significant. One of the commitments that the Council of Bishops made during that time, or that was expressed at the beginning of that, was that it was our intention to love, serve, and lead all United Methodists, and to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, and to live and teach the three simple rules, and also to continue as a council to engage in vigorous conversation about not only this matter, but a variety of sensitive issues in the life of the cultures represented in the United Methodist Church and in the church at large. And also that we were intentional not only engaging that conversation internally, but using our leadership capacity to invite the whole church to be in continuing conversation. So I want to turn to Bishop Sally Dick to give us an update on how conversations following the witness proceeded today.
Yes, I too want to give my appreciation to all those who have been working really since we came to General Conference to have a time of dialogue, what we have called Holy Conferencing. And as we have been in dialogue, we have been hopeful that we would be able to respond to the whole church. And so after, as you know, after some of the votes yesterday, there was a great concern that there be pastoral care, particularly from the Council of Bishops, for the whole church. As we came together for the faithful witness this morning, then we went into a time of discussion and speaking from our hearts, as much as our heads. I hope it was more our hearts of hearing each other and to begin to develop some of the trust that will be needed for the ongoing conversations that we hope to have. I want to emphasize that as I was in dialogue with those earlier this morning, really at the last minute before the session started, I just asked for bishops to come from the full perspective of the church, from all perspectives, because we are bishops of the whole church. And so I was pleased that so many stepped forward to provide that pastoral care and that holy conferencing. I'm also appreciative that for the good of our whole church, the covenant was kept. And I think that that's something that is important to all of us.
Today has been a better day than yesterday. We have been talking since before arriving in Fort Worth with members of the bishop's team to help reach out to those who would be affected by the decisions made yesterday, and with Gail Murphy-Geis and others on that team, and that has been very, very helpful to have that discussion before getting here, and then quite often while getting here. I want to express thanks to the Just Peace team, who also helped in mediating talks with between us. It's felt like daily, but I don't think that's correct. And helped us overcome some sticking points so that we would be able to continue working together in good dialogue and in covenant with one another. Before coming, Reconciling Ministries Network developed a theme of one family tree to be our witness while we were here at General Conference. That theme stated our commitment to the church, being one family, including all of God's children. And those children include people of all sexual orientations and gender identities, gay children, straight children, lesbian children, bisexual children, transgender children. All children are included in that one family tree. So in that theme, we were stressing our unity in the church and the fact that some may consider this a family discussion, which it indeed is within our United Methodist community, even though it affects beyond our own church as well. So as we came committed to that, it became clear in the discussions with the team that it looked like we would be able to work out, even in difficult situations, a faithful witness for the church and for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people. On the day before, yesterday, with the votes that came down so what we considered harshly against inclusion for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people, we were in shock that that the votes went in the way they did on membership particularly. And as a result of that, our community was hurting. Our community had to process what that meant and what would be an appropriate response for that. And so through the late evening, we discerned and prayed, and at the end of that conversation in the late evening had concluded that there would have to be civil disobedience today, that we would have to have a number of our people arrested in our late, late night meeting. And it was only the team of relationships that was built starting from before General Conference and through these meetings that allowed us this morning to continue holy conversation and to be able to shift that witness from what we felt was necessary to what you saw today, which I think beautifully told the story of Good Friday, of the church at a place where it feels broken, but also where we expect Easter to come through someday, but we weren't there yet. And the witness we ended at Good Friday, and the bishops came to join us and go forward into future conversation.
I joined these conversations just today when the leadership of the Council of Bishops, after negotiations that you've just heard about, asked for volunteers to be willing to come and go out with the team of 12 witnesses for these conversations. It is a diverse group of bishops from all the jurisdictions and Africa, Asia, and Europe. It represents a wide variety of theological perspectives and has been a fruitful beginning. I think I want to emphasize my ministry as a bishop of the whole church is in part a ministry of bridge building. Bishop Dick and I have traveled to several places over the last 3 years since our elections to try to engage in conversations with people. Sometimes those conversations are uncomfortable. We show up places that we would not normally be expected to show up. But I have been impressed by her willingness to engage in a ministry of unity. She has chaired the Council of Bishops Task Force on Unity, and I have served under her leadership. And this ministry of bridge building is something that I'm deeply committed to. And so when the request came this morning, I was one of the first to say, I'm in, count me as part of the group. That was part of what we were trying to do. I think we ought to emphasize, though, that these conversations are not an attempt to usurp the rights of the General Conference. These are some conversations. There are lots of these conversations that go on in the life of the church, but we think they can bear fruit. Understanding, though, that the delegates of the General Conference, either the ones that's currently meeting or the next future General Conferences, are also going to be needing to engage in these conversations and the way in which they are guided and carried out so that all the voices are heard and the General Conference can prayerfully reach its conclusions. That's something that we have to respect as well.
I'll just say on behalf of the Commission that we've been working for 4 years to try to make this General Conference better than previous ones. And we came with some petitions in that regard, but we also saw our role as facilitating holy conferencing that the bishops and others wanted to have facilitated. And that our goal in these conversations, at least to come to the witness, were to balance maintaining the rules of the General Conference, which are valued by all the delegates, with hearing the voices of everyone in the church, which is also valued by our church. So that was our role, to facilitate those conversations. And I would also want to add that, in case you haven't seen it, that the witness is now up on the Internet. There was a little confusion during the witness that it had fallen off the live feed, but we simply go off Internet during breaks, and that's what we did. But it was recorded, and it just took a few hours to get it uploaded onto the Internet, so everyone can see it there through a link from the General Conference website. Okay.
Thank you. We'll take questions from the floor now.
Cynthia Estelle, United Methodist Nexus. That was a great lead-in for my question, Dr. Murphy-Geis. Thank you. This is an email that I received this afternoon from a UM Nexus reader. In considering comments made by General Conference leadership following the witness moment, events suggest that the plug was pulled on the video stream to deny viewers a negative side of the United Methodist Church. The notice that showed on the screen was not the usual on-break scene, but a notice suggesting loss of signal. There is a full audio clip. Why not a full video clip? This was a momentous event for the United Methodist Church. It was also potentially embarrassing. It remains seemingly likely that the loss of video feed to the Internet was no accident. Thank you for considering this. Signed, Jim Wagner, St. Louis. How would you respond?
Yeah, I can assure you it was an accident. We, as Troy mentioned, when we got together at 7 o'clock this morning, things were tense, difficult, anxiety-filled. It was about 9 o'clock when we left that room, and we all had about an hour and a half to assemble 12 bishops without first speaking to the council, to get memos to the various players, our worship leaders. I said, make sure the screens are on, make sure the mics are live. I didn't say make sure the Internet was live. I didn't even know there was Internet to assure. I'm not exactly sure what errands we were all running, but we barely, and Troy had to go back to his coalition partners who were planning for maybe the worst case scenario. So it was simply an hour and a half of frantic trying to get memos to everyone. It was absolutely not that. In fact, I'm very proud of that witness, and I would not have wanted it taken off my husband. I told him, look at the live feed, a witness is coming, and he texted me, it fell off the Internet, and I said, oh, we're going to have to take care of that, even during it. So it was definitely an accident. The plug was not pulled.
One of the follow-up questions was that the video of the witness was separated from the statement that Bishop McCleskey gave during the business session. And one of the complaints that I've been receiving from readers is that they feel like they've not gotten the whole picture of what happened today. How would you respond to that?
I haven't seen it yet, so I'll take a look. Maybe we can get it all of a piece. I'm sure that, I mean, the directions to our tech people are to break off all video, et cetera, for breaks. So it may not have been as clear to them where the break was, since he called it a very special recess and very few people left. So Again, my suspicion is that the tech people were trying to figure out where the break was, and maybe we can get it all as a piece eventually. Certainly, where the business part goes, it will be in the DCA, and that will be available, and then the whole of it should be available. It may not be of a piece right now, so we'll see if we can do that.
Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Bruce Pettit from the California-Nevada Instant Connection. Bishop Palmer, you talked about the commitment of the Council of Bishops, and I'm wondering how deep the commitment goes and among how many bishops it goes. We've had demonstrations now for at least the last three general conferences regarding this issue. In Cleveland in 2000, as you know, there were even arrests. So how deep is the commitment and among how many to change at least the language in the Book of Discipline about incompatibility?
The commitment to which I referred both in the prepared statement this morning and at the beginning of this press briefing was to be engaged in dialogue with each other and to continue to lead the church in holy conversation and conferencing about this and other sensitive matters. There is no specific commitment on the part of the council at this point that we've concluded by vote or consensus together that the council is going to be working to change the language in the discipline to which you refer. I know there are many voices and persons in the that colleague community of bishops that's the outcome they would like to see. And I'm sure there is great support for that. I don't think we can come to a consensus about what, if anything, the council would wish to see changed in the paragraphs that we've been talking about in the Book of Discipline until the council really crosses the Rubicon of having deep conversation with each other.
And if I might, one more question. Bishop Talbert today made reference to a parallel between what happened here and what happened in 1939 with the creation of the central jurisdiction. Do you think that the people who vote against or rather for the status quo on all these issues, do you think they understood the parallel and do you think they thought it was valid?
I certainly understand what Bishop Talbert said, and since his statement this morning, I've heard mixed responses to that, none of which suggested to me that any individual who expressed an opinion that I heard did not understand the analogy that he made, but no consensus that I heard that there is agreement with that analogy. Some buy it in total, and others have expressed resentment for the analogy.
I would like to say one of the strengths of the witness this morning was there were a few Holy Spirit moments in it, and that were not planned, and one of those was Bishop Talbert finding his way onto the floor and saying which microphone is live, and finding microphone number 8, and speaking. And when I heard his voice, my heart was warmed and thankful to hear that strong, strong supporter and prophetic voice during our witness.
Linda Bloom, United Methodist News Service. I'm wondering what the plan is for the rest of General Conference. Are there going to be, I realize that's only until tomorrow, but are there going to be any other conversations? What will happen?
We have a meeting tomorrow, and as you indicate, we don't have a whole lot of time left on site. And so tomorrow our meeting will be focused more about how do we go forward from here. Again, to underscore what Bishop Jones said, we have no intention of superseding whatever the General Conference has done, but we do want to build on relationships and trust so that we can use this as an opportunity for new hope to emerge. And when I invited people to come and join us, I said as soon as we leave that room and go into a room for holy conversation, I have no idea where it will go. Your walk, that's what holy conferencing is about. You're walking a new road. You're making a new road. Or as Robert Quinn says, you're building the bridge while you're walking on it. And that's really what we're doing.
Ann Craig from GLAAD, Gay Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, working with Reconciling Ministries Network. I have a question for the bishops in terms of some of the positive legislation that was passed that included civil rights, affirming civil rights for gay people, encouraging churches and families not to reject their young people and their members, and resources to resist discrimination, print resources for churches. And I was wondering if the bishops can take some leadership, or do you plan on taking leadership on making sure these get implemented? Because I know, for instance, the teen suicide recommendation that's been on the books for about 3 or 4 quadrennium has never gotten any programmatic action.
I'm absolutely confident that we will take collectively and in our respective responsibilities as residential bishops, speaking for the active bishops, that those resources, for example, are available. I am already aware that there are bishops who are working in their annual conferences and episcopal areas to make sure that their conference structures and policies and things that are going on in those communities where they serve are places of hospitality and not hostility, even if the context is not an especially religious or so-called spiritual one. Many of us have spoken out on civil and human rights for all persons, but in particular for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered persons relative to things, particularly in response to hate crimes in public schools and that kind of thing. So, yes, we will be. How we will be, I do not know at this point. And so I don't want to state what I can't live by, but suffice it to say it's going on now, and there will be a heightened interest in making sure that these resources and other directions are followed through on thoughtfully and intentionally.
I'm Robin Russell from the United Methodist Reporter. It seemed to me as an observer that a lot of folks have been through this before, and while disheartened, kind of said, well, you know, we just press on. But young adults seem to be particularly disturbed and distraught. What's the general sense that you have now after some of the dialogue has taken place?
Our young adults have been very powerful this general conference in both their actions and their words. They have spoken their truth, both on the street corners through rallies and in the church sanctuary where we've been based, to talk about what it means to have a church with a future with hope and what it means for their generation, where they are concerned that they can't bring their friends to church because the church isn't welcoming, and that in the church, 80% of young people are concerned that that the church has anti-gay policies, and outside the church, 91% of young people are concerned that the church has anti-gay policies and don't consider trying the United Methodist Church. That's a huge concern of Mosaic, which is the extension ministry of Reconciling Ministries Network, and the Young Persons Division of the United Methodist Church, and not just in the United Methodist Church, but other denominations as well. But you saw them with drums. You saw them remembering the story of Joey Heath, a young United Methodist that was refused transfer of membership in the South Georgia Annual Conference, and so rallying around him, supporting change in the church. We need to listen to these young voices. We had them lead us this general conference. I think actually we have a good model for the church, in that in some of their actions and some of our witnesses, they took the lead, we followed them, and when people came to us, the older persons, to say, what do we do next, we were coached to say, go to the leader. And it was someone that they hadn't expected to be the leader because they were young.
Olin Lindy Mood from the Rocky Mountain Conference Communications Team. I come knowing that early in the week there were conversations about the legislative groups having holy conversation, and it sounded like a wonderful experience that was emerging. And then as the conference continued, our legislative solution seemed to be a bit of a violation of the holy conversations that occurred in those smaller units. And I'm just wondering if there's a way that as we approach the year 2012, if there can be some ways that our holy conversation does not get lost in the legislative solutions that are presenting an inauthentic voice for the whole of our denomination. And I'm wondering if anyone can speak to the forums that might emerge for preparation for 2012.
I heard that the commission's petition to shrink the general conference failed with no votes in favor of it, so that's not going to happen. I'm a little sad, but, you know, it's a large institution, and so the legislation becomes necessary at some point. So I just wanted to mention that since we brought it up at the beginning, that it may be that a large legislative meeting is not the best way to do holy conferencing, that it would be between now and then in the interim. So maybe you all want to talk about that.
Three of us on this platform were members of the Faith and Order Legislative Committee at the 2000 General Conference. My reading of that, and Sally and Gail may give a different one, but my reading of that was in 11 hours of discussion on this issue, that was holy conferencing. And yet when we moved into the plenary, others described the plenary decisions as painful, and of course the arrests were very disturbing to all. My experience of these matters is that holy conferencing requires a great deal of time, a relatively small group, and high levels of trust. How you do that, even with 500, let alone 1,000, in 10 days, I would remind you as a historian that General Conference in the 1830s met for 40 days with a smaller group of people, all of whom were clergy. So I think if you really want to do holy conferencing with the entire group, you're looking at a month-long General Conference in order to facilitate that kind of relationship building. I think part of what needs to happen in the church is what's been going on really for the last 36 years, a variety of conversations in a variety of places. And yet every time somebody new comes who wasn't a part of earlier conversations, part of my respect for Sally Dick and my partnership with her in the council was born 8 years ago. We didn't talk much for 4 years, and then we end up in the council together and find out we have a lot more in common than we suspected. It's that kind of trusting relationship you've got to find ways of building, and it's just really hard to do when you have a body whose job is to act on petitions from any single person who wants to send them in.
And let me say, I mean, you know, we're one day out, so as soon as this is over, the 2008 General Conference, I think that, you know, maybe even part of our agenda as this holy conversation that we have put together today, maybe we begin to talk about what we do for 4 years. I mean, the other thing about a relationship is you can't just let it drop for 4 years. And we know that different people will come on board. It's the opposite of survivor, you know what I mean? It's how do you keep
voted on the island?
Yeah, you keep voting them on the island, and you have to be able to find a way to make that a peace island, even as that happens. I think that there are things that we need to begin to think about right away, and we'll see what those are. And as we hear about some good ideas, we'll begin to explore them.
Not to pile on to the question with the responses, but in following up on Bishops Dick and Jones, that is precisely one of the unique roles that the council can play. While there will be new people voted onto the island, so to speak, there is a continuing community there that will be enriched and enlarged, and so that save for someone passing away, everyone there now will still be there when others are voted onto the island at the elections in the jurisdictional and the central conferences. So if we keep our word to stay in covenant for holy conversation with each other. And if we are able to share both those conversations and some of the fruit of that conversation in some creative way, and I don't know what that is, with the whole church, I believe it will have the effect in part of seeding conversations in many other places.
The question brought to my mind the experience of week one versus week two of General Conference. And in week one of experiencing the subcommittees and the committees as being able to listen to one another and to talk with one another and face-to-face find out where people are and getting those results from subcommittees that feel positive and also where people feel heard. And then the week two. Week two, where any of the trust built in the subcommittees or the recommendations of majority reports of subcommittees are completely questioned and thrown out, it seems to me, as if there's no wisdom behind them. So it'd be wonderful to how do we track the wisdom from week one into week two in a way that doesn't betray it so completely, and not just on lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender issues, but on many issues. And I had to smile when we talked about voting people on the island. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people and their families and friends constantly feel they're voted off the island. And by 55-45 this time, it felt like that happened again and are still there doing faithful witnesses to say, yes, we are on the island. See us. Remember us. Include us in the family fully and completely.
Catherine Johnson, the editor of the Social Questions Bulletin, the publication of the Methodist Federation for Social Action. And Troy, when you began talking about the feeling of being in shock, I think that many of us are feeling that way. And it harkens back to the same feeling I had when we heard the results of Judicial Council 1032. We had had a board meeting just the week before, knowing that was coming up at MFSA. And I said to my board, there's just no way that decision will be made. And then it was, and I was in shock. And as we prepared for General Conference, we saw what happened at annual conferences, and this is my question, is the 20, I think it was 21 annual conferences that responded to 1032, saying that this was not their understanding of what the church was about and membership and pastoral authority and how people are included in the body. So my question has to do with, I'm interested in your reflections on how, in my perception, across the church, there has been a response that this is not who we are, and yet we come to General Conference and find that we are leaving with decision 1032 intact and pastors still able to say to people in the case that was brought before the Judicial Council that because of your sexual orientation, you may not join this church. So I'm just interested in your reflections how whether you share my perception that that's where the church was and how we can then come to General Conference and leave in such a different place.
I think the case that arose out of Virginia that led to decision 1032 and other cases are, in my experience, isolated cases. I served for many years in the North Texas Conference. I've now been bishop in Kansas. The conservative pastors who are most vocal in support of the current language in the discipline, many of them, I know, have been willing to receive gay and lesbian people into their congregations. And so while the decision was made on the basis of pastoral discretion and allowing that, and feels to some like it was an excluding of gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and queer people, in reality, there were some people voting, I know, who thought this was being made on the principle of pastoral discretion. And so there's really no contradiction between deciding a procedural matter, and the bulk of the church, I would say in my experience, 99% of the church, not discriminating in the way that those two cases that have been mentioned did.
It's very dismaying to leave this general conference with 1032 still in place. It's hard to imagine going back home and sharing with our congregations and families and friends what it means that this general conference did not undo 1032, the group of people known as the United Methodist Church, by, I believe, a 51-49% vote, very split, right down the middle, could not change a few words to ensure that that would not happen based solely on sexual orientation. That's a grief for our people, and we pray for healing for that. We also hope that the new slate of judicial council members who were elected that I believe are fair-minded and won't allow bias to enter into their decisions might somehow be asked to reconsider 1032 again and see if they can do a better job than the preceding judicial council did, which we believe was an overstepping, which provoked a consensual letter from the council of bishops saying such. And so we're hoping this new judicial council will be able to do that. But since they're fair-minded, I believe we elected a fair-minded judicial council. If we don't help legislatively, the same harsh decisions can come if we don't help change the language legislatively.
I think we've already quite exceeded our time. If you have a question that you could quickly ask so we can wrap up going to our panelists have other commitments to go to.
Tom Griffith, I'm a correspondent with UM Nexus. It's been my observation that in many of our churches, perhaps at least in the ones I've seen the majority, there is at least one couple who came of age just before or during World War II, or both of them are widowed, or perhaps one is divorced, one is widowed. They would like companionship and intimacy in their older years. And they are seen as a couple. They may have two houses, they may have one, but everybody knows they're sleeping in they're sleeping together, and the laity are cheering them on. I'm wondering what the Council of Bishops will do to ask the church to extend to those who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, the same grace that we extend to heterosexuals who are as outside of the rules of and teachings of the church as are the lesbian and gay, bisexual, queer people.
I'm not tracking the question. I got the images, and then you're saying, what will the Council of Bishops?
What are you going? We have a group of people who are as equally outside of the teachings of the church as are the lesbian and gay, bisexual people. We are welcoming and cheering on these older couples. What are you going to do to try to help the churches be as grace-filled and offering grace to those who are gay and lesbian as they do to these older heterosexual couples?
Well, let me say, I feel duty-bound to say I'm not aware that the Council of Bishops has been cheering on your first illustration. I certainly am familiar with it, and so I don't want to play coy or naive. I think, you know, we haven't been cheerleading for that, and I'm sure that the council would be open to discussing other sensitive matters about family arrangements, if I may use that terminology, that have emerged in more recent times, perhaps more frequently. But I don't know how we would go about that. But I do see, as I said earlier, there are many sensitive conversations that we need to have. Human sexuality, family structure, war, peace, and violence. Specific reference has been made to the need for the council and the church to continue to be in dialogue about the matter of race. But I'm not aware that we've been advocating one way or the other around your illustration.
Somewhat related to this, and I'm not speaking for the bishops at all, But we received mail at the commission because we had invited George Bush to speak at this general conference, as we had invited President Sirleaf, because the policy is that United Methodist heads of state are invited to come. And people were not happy about, some people were not happy about our inviting George Bush. And I responded to them that the United Methodist Church is overall not in the business of deciding whether or not people are good United Methodists. They just are. And we invite them. And I, you know, again, not speaking to them, but in general, I would say that that's true. We're not in the business of judging one another's Christianity. We're in the business of grace. So not as a bishop, but...
Well, I was going to say something similar in the sense of, you know, that's one of the reasons I love being a United Methodist, is our understanding of grace. And when we begin to judge, even in the circles that we know, you know, things, but when we begin to judge, it's such a slippery slope. We call people to be their very best. And we call people to live healthy, holy lives. Because that is our tradition. Personal holiness is our tradition. But the judging part is just not up to us. We don't know people's intentions. We don't know what people, even their actions at times. And so that's one of the things I love about United Methodists.
In the midst of all the difficult things that went on over the last 4 days of debate, one of the things that pleased me is the level in which United Methodist doctrine was brought into play on all sides of the arguments. Bishop Hsu Jung in his sermon nailed it. It's about the tension we experience between holiness and hospitality. And what constitutes holiness? This is something we have argued about for, well, you know, since Wesley coined the general rules. What your question points up to is precisely that tension. Every local church I know of wrestles with people whose names are on the membership rolls, who play various levels of activity, and yet might be in tension with the church's official teaching at various places. And so that's something that gets negotiated at a practical level in local congregations. The job of the General Conference is to clarify our official doctrine. And as somebody who's taught United Methodist doctrine for decades, I was glad to see the conversation at a higher level than in previous General Conferences.
I want to avoid any implication that LGBT persons aren't people who believe in holy living. There's not a contrasting way of living within faithful families that are monogamous and loving and go to the United Methodist Church every Sunday, pay their pledges, raise their children, take them to confirmation, want them to be baptized at the appropriate time, and seek the blessing of the church on that. Holy living is not limited to heterosexuality. And I just want us to not try and place those in separate categories, but this is a human sexuality question. And my partner and I practice holy living. My 10th anniversary was while we were here. So I had some cell phone calls I needed to make. But let's understand that holy living is not the limit of one particular persuasion of sexuality or sexual orientation. And I was amiss in earlier not saying that in this witness was a coalition of partners called Common Witness. And Common Witness consisted of Affirmation, Reconciling Ministries Network, and the Methodist Federation for Social Action is Common Witness. And we are assisted by Soul Force in some of the negotiations. So I didn't want to shirk duty and responsibility to our team that's been working so hard together.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming today, and thank you very much to our panel.